For those of you who weren't here yesterday, and for those who were and forgot what we did yesterday, we started with an overview of chapters 1 and 2, and we focused on a couple of themes that will continue to unfold today and throughout the week. One was that central element of the prologue about this alternation between what it means to be born of God and to be born of one of three alternatives: of the will of the flesh, of the will of a man, or of the will of blood. Today we're going to look at what it might mean to be born of the will of the flesh. We also looked a little more closely at the two scenes that initiate Jesus' public ministry in John's Gospel, and how they call on Hebrew Scripture in the past and the current conditions in the world of John's Gospel to announce both the overflowing and endless messianic banquet, the party that goes on forever, symbolized by the Feast of Cana, and then the prophetic act of public witness in Jesus' confrontation with the temple in Jerusalem, which was not living in accordance with the covenant, which was not providing life the way it was supposed to be doing. So those two halves of Jesus' ministry are going to come cycling around throughout the gospel: the announcement of celebration and the critique of what isn't the way it should be. And as we saw at the end of yesterday, Jesus had tried to explain his action in the temple by giving one of these mysterious statements, which he's going to give another one up today. Yesterday it was, "Tear down this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days." And the narrator gave us the answer to that one. He was talking about the temple of his body. Today we'll have to work a little bit harder to figure out what the statement is about. Before we get into it, we need to pay attention to how we read. Yesterday I asked the question of how many of us were taught that the Bible is funny, and one or two people raised their hand. And I said, if there's one thing you remembered from yesterday, it's that the Bible is meant to be funny. There's one thing to remember from today, it's that every word counts. We live in a culture where words are throwaway. The newspaper comes out in tens of thousands of words every day, and it goes in the recycling bin, and my God, it's even worse with the internet. They're not even really there, and they're gone. And so we skim. We have so many words thrown at us. The best most of us can do in our busy lives in the newspaper is read the headlines or, try and find a quick point. We listen to 30-second sound bites in the 6 o'clock news, and, we try and extract the important point, and we often think of the rest of it as this clothing that the point comes in. We can throw away the clothing once we get to the flesh underneath. But the ancients didn't think of words that way. Words had sacred power that came with them. As we saw already in this gospel's beginning and calling on the beginning from Genesis, that's how God made everything. Right? God said, and it came to be. Words made things happen. Words defined realities. They weren't just containers of information. They were the reality. To this day, in the Jewish mystical tradition, one of the most powerful ways of getting in touch with the intimate presence of God is by meditating over individual letters of the alphabet and of particular words. Words bore and continue to bear power. They've lost a lot of that power in our culture. Not only did words bear power, but for the gospel writers in their culture, literacy, as we know, was unusual. Written texts were very rare. They had to depend on an oral culture. And as any of you who've ever read stories to little kids know, people in oral cultures remember every word in its place. Your laughing tells me you know. For those of you who don't know, when I read stories from the library to my 5-year-old son, if I read it the second time and I change something, he says to me with a sneer, "Read it right." Can't get away with one little piece of changing it. And oral cultures were like that. Every word was important. Every word was in its place. They listened carefully for every word. They weren't looking for the point, the moral of the story. Every word was there. And as we start this passage, I want to give us a little exercise to do to see how that happens. So if you all have Bibles handy, or if you don't, maybe you can share with your neighbor, or next time if you didn't get a chance to pick one up. Does anybody not have one that would like one? We can pass some around. Oh, good, everybody's good. Great. We'll be looking mostly at John 3, but I'd like to start with the way the narrator sets it up in the couple of verses before that. We remember in 22, verse 22 in chapter 2, the narrator had told us that after Easter, after the resurrection, the disciples remembered what Jesus had said and began to believe. And then the narrator adds a little transition. And I'd like to read these couple of verses in my version and then hear other people's versions that may sound different, and we can listen for the differences. Now, when he was at Jerusalem at the Passover, at the feast, many people believed in his name, having seen the signs that he performed. But Jesus did not entrust himself to them, because he knew them all, and had no need for anyone to bear witness about human beings, for he himself knew what was in a person. No. Someone who's got something a little different, why don't you share that with us, please?
In Jerusalem during Passover, many people put their faith in Jesus because they saw him work miracles. But Jesus knew what was in their hearts, and he would not let them have power over him. No one had to tell him what people were like. He already knew.
Wow. What translation is it? Are you reading from?
Contemporary English.
Contemporary English. Wow, that's very different. Huh? Does somebody have another one that's different?
Yeah.
Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. But Jesus did not trust himself to them, because he knew all men and needed no one to bear witness of man, for he himself knew what was in man.
Okay, different still. Anybody have another one? Yeah.
When he was in Jerusalem during the Passover festival, many believed in his name because they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, would not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to testify about anyone, for he himself knew what was in everyone.
Okay. Now, besides the actual verbal differences, what meaning differences did anybody hear there among the different translations? What's at issue that the translators are struggling to get across? Did you get a handle on any of that? I'll give you a clue. Who's the they that Jesus doesn't trust?
Pharisees. Maybe the Pharisees.
Maybe the Pharisees.
People who believed in signs, or believed because of signs.
People who believed because of signs.
All people.
All people. Now, see, that's a big difference, isn't it? Is it some small subset, the Pharisees? Is it all these people who are like the dazzle and flash, are mesmerized by that, or is it everybody? Huh. Well, let's look at one more translation difference as the scene comes to pass. Let's look at the transition from 2:25 to 3:1. Maybe we can hear a couple versions of that before I give you mine. Anybody just like to read those two verses? 2:25 and 3:1.
Now there was a Pharisee named Nicodemus.
Can you start back the verse before, please? 2:25 and then 3:1.
And needed no one to testify about anyone, for he himself knew what was in everyone. Now there was a Pharisee named Nicodemus, a leader of the Jews.
Okay. How about another version, please?
And needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus.
Okay. You hear the difference? Mm-hmm. What did you hear? What did anybody hear that was different there? That means something different, besides the fact that the words were different.
Man.
What about man?
It's a man of the Pharisees.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is one of our struggles. Yesterday, we talked about being overly gender inclusive around the point of being born of the will of a man. And some of our translations have taken away a word there that is meant to be male and made it inclusive incorrectly. Here, in the attempt to take a word which is meant to be inclusive, anthropos, humanity, human beings, the translation, I forget who it was over here who read that translation, then it follows, he knew all human beings, or he knew what was in a person, there was a Pharisee. And you completely lose the connection that the gender exclusive version had. It's possible to have both and here. It could have been, had no need to bear witness about humanity, for he himself knew what was in a person. Now there was a person of the Pharisees, Nicodemus by name. Now you see what's happening here? The narrator is giving a description of this reaction to this incredible act of overturning everything in Jerusalem. And here comes one of them right now. That's what you get in the didn't trust himself to a man. He knew it was in a man. Now there was a man. And it just flows right into another. When you have this sharp distinction between he knew it was in human nature, now there was a Pharisee, it's like pause, rest, new chapter, you know, whole new scene. Whereas originally this is a continuity. It's like you start with the grand global view and then we focus our camera in here a little bit and now we get a close-up. Here comes this encounter between one of these people who believes because of the signs and Jesus. Now what do we know, what are we told about Nicodemus? We're told an incredible amount about him right away in this first verse. What do we know about him?
He was a leader.
A leader. Leader of what?
Okay.
A leader, a ruler of the Jews or Judeans. Let's say something here about Jews and Judeans in John's Gospel. The Greek word judeioi. Judeioi can certainly mean Jews, Jewish people. But much more literally, and I would suggest much more appropriately to John's Gospel, it means Judeans. People from the land of Judea. Just like Americans, from the land of America. And it's an incredibly important distinction to make, even though almost no official translations make it. I mean, if you can remember a second thing from the session, try this one. Obviously, everybody in this story, except the Samaritan woman, is Jewish. So to say that the opponents of Jesus, as the word judeioi will take on as we go further on, we might as well start the issue here, were Jews, is incredibly misleading. It'd be like us talking about some group of Christians we didn't like and calling them the Christians. Well, but that's all of us too. That doesn't say who we're talking about. So who are these opponents? Well, some translators have struggled to say, well, it's the leaders. It's the Jewish rulers. It's not the ordinary Jews. It's just the officials that are at issue. And certainly in this scene, it is an official who's at issue. We're not only told he's a Judean, but he's a ruler, a leader of the Judeans, and a Pharisee. We'll get back to that in a minute. But the Judeans, as we'll see, is not just an issue that refers to people who are rulers. Later in the week, when we look at John 6, we'll see that there's an incredible switch in the characterization of Jesus' opponents from being those who have come from Galilee, from Tiberias, when they saw Jesus, they came from Tiberias to see Jesus in the wilderness, and then after the feeding in the wilderness, the great feeding of the loaves of bread, they follow him. They're clearly still in Galilee, and they're referred to as judeioi. And one could say, well, how can they be Judeans then, Wes, if they're in Galilee? And I want to suggest that what this gospel is about, as it is throughout, is symbolic geography. Judeans refers throughout this gospel not simply to people who are literally from the land of Judea, but to people who identify with Judea as the way things are supposed to be. Nicodemus represents the pinnacle of that kind of belief. He's the leader of those people. He's the one who says what it means to be a Judean. But very ordinary people can identify with being Judeans. A couple of examples from our culture. I used to work in Washington, D.C. As all of us obviously know, Washington, D.C. exists because the federal government is there. No matter what you think about government, whether you think government just takes your money and throws it away, or you think government's a vehicle for compassion and justice, or anywhere on that spectrum, if you live in Washington, D.C., and you run a dry cleaning shop or a grocery store or whatever, you're sure glad the federal government's there, and you want it to grow. The more federal employees, the better, right? Run a hotel in Washington, D.C.? Great. Let's have all the conventions we can possibly have here. The more government activity, the better. Well, Jerusalem was like that. Jerusalem was a capital city. It was a religious center and a governmental center to the extent that the Israelites at this point in their history had any government to speak of under the Roman Empire. But it was a center also of commerce. Three times a year, all Jews from throughout the Mediterranean were expected, not all did, of course, but were expected to come to Jerusalem and spend a lot of money. You know, they have to spend money on lodgings and food and sacrificial animals and tithing and all these things. No matter what you think of the religious establishment, you're sure glad Jerusalem is the capital of the universe in the Jewish mindset. Whether you're a practicing person or you're just an ordinary person trying to make a living, you're really glad that the religion requires everybody to come there. An example from my neck of the woods, since many of you know where Squim is, you might relate to this story. Let's take Boeing, for example, in Seattle. And this would apply to any big business in any big city. No matter what you think of airplanes or defense spending, people are sure glad Boeing is in Seattle. And if you challenge Boeing's practices, boy, do people get mad at you. Whether you work there or not. Because Boeing's one of the biggest supporters of churches and schools and United Way and everything else that is holy and good. So what happens is that when an area becomes economically dependent on some big institution, people defend the ideology of that institution and are threatened when someone threatens it, even if they don't personally believe in it. Judeans in this story are those who defend Jerusalem's point of view against Jesus' point of view, which is the primary ideological battle in this story. And it's going to come across in this scene as the battle between what is flesh and what is spirit. Okay. So Nicodemus is a ruler of the Judeans and a Pharisee. What does it mean that he's a Pharisee? Who are the Pharisees? You've heard of them, haven't you?
Very righteous Jews who had very strict laws that they observed and certain things on the side of the tablet, things like that.
Right? Okay, strict laws. Where do their laws come from?
The Old Testament. From the Old Testament.
The Old Testament? Is that all?
They added to it some.
They added to it. Yeah, were you gonna, is that what you were going to say?
All the oral traditions were incorporated in varying degrees because it was a very broad subset of people from, you mentioned, the very strict to the virtually non-observant.
Okay.
They're upholders of a world order that began after the Babylonian captivity.
Okay. So they've developed a new world order, this post-exilic reality for Israel. They've said, in contrast to those who are strict interpreters of the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses says, don't add one word to this law. God's given you everything you need to know. Don't touch it. Don't take away from it. Don't add to it. They've said, well, life continues to unfold a little bit here, and there are some new things that we might need to know, and there are some new rules and traditions, especially when life exists under an oppressive empire where we're not the big establishment, we're just sort of a little establishment, and we have to try and figure out what does it mean to be holy people in this context. Okay, when the promised land isn't really ours anymore, it's a colony of the Roman Empire. And, of course, that was, if you will, the liberal point of view. The conservative point of view, represented by the Sadducees and some others, the chief priests and the priestly establishment in general, was that, no, the Torah alone is the determinant of what it means to be a Jew. Now, this is a power struggle, right? For the priests and the Sadducees, the issue is the Torah is the law, and we're in charge of the Torah. And we're in charge of the sacrificial system in Jerusalem that enacts much of that Torah law. The Pharisees are the holders of the oral law. They're in charge of that. And for the Pharisees, one of the claims was that, and this will come up again later on in the week, that piety can be practiced not only in synagogue and in temple, but at home. Through your table fellowship, how you eat, how you deal with eating utensils and the home things and some of the things in the Synoptic Gospels Jesus is critical of, that they've been raised up. The traditions of the ancestors have been raised up as if they were God's law. You tithe cumin and mint, etc. You know some of those things from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those specifics aren't brought up here. But to say the Pharisees are those who have brought piety to the ordinary person. They're the liberals in a lot of ways. They're the people who have shown themselves open to the possibility of newness. That God didn't stop speaking many hundreds of years ago, and that God continues to live and speak in new ways. It's precisely those people who are the opponents of this Johannine community, this community of disciples gathered around John's gospel, because they're the ones who have the power to make a difference. The conservatives are beyond the pale. I mean, they're just not open to any of this. They're not open to the Pharisees, let alone open to Jesus. The Pharisees are the ones, as we'll see as we look at Nicodemus more deeply in his next scene, are the ones who can make a difference. So that's what's in the background as this scene unfolds. Okay. Now, I've set up the scene on the board here, as I did yesterday with the prologue, in this form of a chiasm, for those of you who weren't here. It's just simply a way of ordering a scene that was common to the ancient world, where the center, in this case, verses 5 and 6, are the most important part, and the surrounding verses, like ripples in a pond around a rock, provide different echoes of it. But the middle is the key here. In this case, it's this challenge we'll see, the second challenge to Nicodemus. The A and A prime parts, the first and last, echo this question of what does it mean to be a teacher? Well, let's look at that here for a moment. For the sake of those in our group who are teaching gender communication, and we're going to talk about that later, I'd like to point out something about how Nicodemus comes to Jesus, man to man. Okay? In this honor-shame culture in this ancient world, it would be appropriate for a man who was a stranger to another man, if he was going to initiate a conversation that didn't have any particular reason to exist, like, you know, can I buy something from you? Or, you know, something very practical like that. By doing it, by honoring the other man, by giving him a sign of respect. Rabbi, we know you are a teacher come from God. For no one can do signs that you do unless God is with them. Okay? So he honors Jesus in two ways, by giving this title Rabbi. Now we can obviously see this is not an official title. It's an honorific title. Jesus hasn't gone to rabbinical school. He hasn't gone to any school. And so for Nicodemus, who is an official teacher, to honor this Jesus who's just disrupted the hell out of everything in Jerusalem, is really quite an act of honor on his part. He could have said, now listen, you scumbag or whatever, you know, how dare you do this? And really dishonored him. That would have been appropriate given the incredibly dishonoring act that Jesus did by going into the temple and throwing everything around. But instead, Nicodemus comes to Jesus as a man respecting another man. Now we'll see on the flip side, when Jesus puts it back in Nicodemus' face again, he says to him, you are a teacher of Israel, and you don't know? We know you are a teacher from God. You are a teacher of Israel, and you don't know. Okay. What's the difference between being a teacher sent from God and a teacher of Israel?
Spirit and law.
Okay. Can I say some more about that?
Well, a teacher from God would be a teacher of the heart and the spirit. I think that's the point that Jesus made.
And a teacher of Israel?
Of the formalities of the establishment, whether it's the law or custom.
Okay.
Purity laws.
Purity laws?
Purity laws. But it's, in addition, let's not make fun of Nicodemus too much here. You know, Nicodemus has never said that he's a bad person. You know, we are not told he's rich or that he's greedy or anything bad about him, other than the fact that he comes at night, which we'll talk about in a moment. Yeah.
I think he's saying he's supposed to be a teacher of Israel. He's supposed to be teaching the spirit behind the laws. Yeah. And all he's doing is teaching the laws. Yeah.
He is, in fact, a teacher of Israel, but there's something missing. To be a teacher of Israel is to hold the office of teacher. You know, to be an ordained minister, if you will. Someone who's devoted their life to the religious tradition and passing that on, interpreting it for people, helping it live in people's lives. For people whose jobs are otherwise, you know, to raise crops and kids and whatever else people have to do, they don't have the luxury of having chosen to make this the focus of their life's energy. Nicodemus, you're supposed to know these things. That's your job. You know, that's your vocation. How is it that you, of all people, don't know what I'm talking about here? So Nicodemus honors Jesus greatly, and Jesus puts it back in Nicodemus' face at the end.
What does the pronoun we mean? Are we to assume that he comes as a spokesman for a larger...
Lovely segue. Boy, what do you think it means? Who's he a representative of, do you think?
would indicate that he's representative of many Pharisees who are starting to have an open mind but are afraid of their position being threatened.
Indeed. Does that make sense to people? Did everybody hear what she said? Representative of other Pharisees who are wondering about this Jesus, who aren't ready to kill him like some of the others may already be, although the text doesn't say they're ready to kill him yet. Yeah.
They say.
We know, they say. But they've come at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now this is one of our first prologue echoes here, huh? Light shines in the darkness at night. What do you make of Nicodemus coming at night?
He didn't want to be seen.
Yeah. No. Is somebody else?
It was also different at night. Back then it was really night.
Yeah. Like 100 yards down the road here, huh? Yeah, at night, under cover of darkness. And as the narrator of Jesus, the text is ambiguous, at the end of this scene goes on to say in 3:19 and 20, this is the basis for the judgment, the crisis, literally. That the light has come into the world, but people love the darkness more than the light, because their deeds were evil. Those who practice, literally, foul things, I love the literal here. Those who do foul things hate the light and do not come to the light, so that their works may not be reproved. But the one who does what is true comes to the light, so that their works may be revealed as having been done in harmony with God. Now, Nicodemus is coming to the light, right? Jesus is the light. We know that from the prologue, and it'll expressly claim in chapter 8, I am the light of the world. So, 2 points for Nicodemus. He comes out of the darkness in toward the light. As we'll see, the picture of Nicodemus throughout the gospel in 3 different places is painted with excruciating ambiguity. I'll tell you more about this a little scene later, but someone once dressed as Nicodemus, I thought it was perfect, came with one half of his face painted white and one half of his face painted black. You know, Nicodemus, as we're going to see, is someone who wants to live in two worlds at the same time and not have to choose, just like all of us. Okay? So, Nicodemus comes at night and gives Jesus his title. And you'd expect in this man-to-man response that Jesus would honor Nicodemus back. Yes, my fellow rabbi, let us converse about God together. You know. And instead, what does he get? Amen, amen, I say to you, unless anyone is born anothen, I'll explain that in a moment, they cannot see the reign of God. He puts a challenge to him. You know. So much for these polite formalities here. Let's get down to business, Nicodemus. Now, that's not the way a man is supposed to respond to another man in a public conversation. So already, Jesus is challenging Nicodemus to maintain his own honor, which in a conversation between two rabbis would take place by them expounding on the meaning of a particular text back and forth, and allowing God to be present in this great flow of ideas and prayerful conversation. But instead, he puts it right to him. That amen, amen, I say to you is a serious beginning as the language could possibly state. Now, born anothen, I have up here somewhere here. What do your translations have there for how someone has to be born?
This one says from above or, quote, in a new way. The same Greek word is used in verses 7 and 31.
You must have a footnote that says that, huh? Okay. Anybody else have
different?
From above or?
Or again.
Well, we'll get to the water and spirit in a minute. Or again. Mm-hmm. Now see, in Greek, it's a lovely double entendre that has to get lost in English. Problem of translation. Anothen means both again and from above. The issue for Nick, just like temple, referred to the building and to the individual human body. Tomorrow, we'll look at the question of what living water means. Living having also an ambiguous reference. Nicodemus has to figure out the puzzle here. What does anothen mean? Does it mean from above? Does it mean again? What is Jesus talking about? Now, in one of the lovely humor scenes, please laugh when you hear this, just for me, huh? They would have laughed. It would have been hilariously funny for them. Nicodemus said, how can a person be born when they are old? One cannot go back in their mother's womb a second time and be born, can they? Okay, a few polite chuckles. to the original audience for this scene, consisting not of rulers of the Judeans for the most part, this is like a political cartoon. This is a mockery of one of the leaders. Here's this teacher of Israel. Listen to this dumb answer he's giving here, you know. Obviously, that's not what Jesus means. You're going to be climbing back into the uterus. You know, he must mean something else. Well, what does he mean? Those of us who like to laugh at Nicodemus's dumb answer.
Almost arrogant, wasn't it, really?
Nicodemus's?
Because yeah. He came seeking truth, and then he's sort of like challenging him.
Yeah.
It's sarcastic.
Yeah. Be sarcastic. But what does Jesus mean? Unless you are born anothen, you cannot see the reign of God. The gospel has a lot to say about seeing and blindness. Yeah.
As Jesus wouldn't have used that Greek word, I'm assuming, do we have a clue what word Jesus would have used?
But see, that's the thing about the gospels, is they're not written in Aramaic. You know, they're written in Greek. These are texts. These are not transcripts. These are documents written so you may believe in Greek to a Greek-speaking audience. Much of this text works because it was written in Greek. I don't know much Aramaic, but this joke wouldn't work in Aramaic. It works because the text was written in Greek. So we have to know that the author is using what was the vernacular, you know, in that whole world there to paint his picture and to present the faith puzzles that we have to figure out in the language that was at hand.
Well, that's a fair question because, for instance, the word that you're trying to describe now is a rather important word, and the concept, the question would be, is there a similar concept in Aramaic?
No,
which is what Christ would have been thinking.
Yeah, see, now we're going to get into it. This is where I said yesterday, I mean, we may get off track here and find some interesting issues to talk about. And if we'd like to pursue this one, I'm happy to do so. This has to do with how we read. Now, are we reading these Gospels as windows into the world of Jesus in the year 20-something, say? Or are we reading them as mirrors reflecting out a story world to a world of readers later in the 80s and 90s and in the 1980s and 90s to ask questions about our lives? For a long time, biblical scholarship used the windows approach. And therefore, John's gospel was garbage because Jesus couldn't have said most of these things. The language isn't right. The way of speaking is so different than the other way of speaking. Some of these stories are not even in the other Gospels. There's no evidence for them. It's structured in an obvious literary construction that doesn't arise in a kind of spontaneous kind of a conversation. Like chiasm, for example, people don't talk in chiasms. They write in chiasms. And so, relatively recently, within the last 20 or 30 years, but really in the last 15 or so, people have emphasized more, rather than saying, let's see the Gospels as the shell that contains a kernel, and let them put Jesus' words in red. That's what's really important here. Let's see them as a story. And I don't mean the word story, as we often do, to mean something that's not true. You know, we in our post-Enlightenment rational universe have this sharp, imagined line between truth and fiction. You know, we categorize them differently in the library and, you know, but of course, we also have docudramas and all kinds of ways that we know. Anybody seen Oliver Stone's JFK or Nixon? Well, are those truth or fiction? Well, they're stories about real people that have been interpreted to make points. And I would suggest that's precisely what the Gospels are. This is a story written, it says so, these signs among many have been told so that you may believe. They're not transcripts. They're not a shell that contains a kernel. They are stories that were told as stories in Greek. Once they get translated, either back into an Aramaic that they were never written in, or into an English that they obviously weren't written in, then we have to struggle a little bit. And this scene between Jesus and Nicodemus was written by someone in Greek. Now, ask me the question, but are you saying that Jesus never talked to Nicodemus? I don't know. Do you? It's not in any of the other Gospels. There's no other Nicodemus stories anywhere in the New Testament.
But wasn't Nicodemus at the burial? I mean, farther in John?
In this Gospel. Oh, he's a very important character in this Gospel. He's not at the burial in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. So I prefer to leave that question aside as an unanswerable one. And ultimately, I would suggest as an irrelevant one. Because by the time this Gospel is written, as we'll see, most of you won't be here, by the very last session, when they have the scene of Thomas, blessed are you who have believed without seeing. See, this story was already written for people who never knew the living Jesus. They knew the risen Jesus. They didn't know what he said. They knew the stories they were told. The stories had power. The stories were what people built their lives around, trusting that they were stories grounded in the life and death and resurrection of someone sent from God, as interpreted through the memory of people later, as the Gospels already told us. At the time, they didn't understand these things, but after he was risen, they remembered, thought it through, and figured it out. And once they figured it out, then they wrote this story. Consciously writing a story, not compiling transcripts.
It's important to remember, too, that the Gospels were written by four different people, four different communities, with different ideas in mind to get across different goals. And so they would naturally pick different stories. It doesn't trouble me that Nicodemus is only John. John is trying to tell his community something that the other writers may not have thought was relevant for their particular community.
Yeah.
And the age of John's Gospel also, I think of telling a story about something that happened 70 years ago. Hey, there was a guy on the inside.
Precisely.
And, you know, it was a lot more interesting 70 years later than it would be too controversial and too tough to tell earlier on.
Indeed. And as we've mentioned some yesterday, as we'll see before today's over, I hope we'll have to move along a little bit to make up for this, but that's okay. That issue that there's one on the inside who believed is not only an old-time issue. Mm-hmm. It's an issue for us, too. Even though there's no more Pharisees and no more Sanhedrin. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on just a little bit. So, we never did get to the question of what did Jesus mean by being born an orphan, but Nicodemus obviously didn't get it the first time, so Jesus gives him another try. Gives him a few more metaphors. In verse 5, etc. Here's the core, verse 5 and 6. Amen, amen, I say to you, unless anyone is born of water and spirit, they cannot enter the reign of God. What is born from flesh is flesh, and what is born from spirit is spirit. I'll just continue a couple more verses. Do not be amazed because I told you, you, plural, must be born an orphan. The wind blows where it wills, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. That nice water and spirit, our summer theme here at Holden. What is Jesus talking about? What's he trying to get Nicodemus to do?
There's a psychological technique that I've seen and heard about where you use chaos to expand somebody's understanding. If somebody's locked into one particular view, then you try to shape the reality enough by asking them questions. And that's what Jesus does over and over again. Rather than giving answers, he turns around and asks questions. Here Nicodemus is locked into one particular view, and Jesus is trying really hard to shape that reality up and make him see beyond that one little tiny focus.
Indeed, Jesus the Zen master, huh? But what does it mean? Okay, you're absolutely right. He's trying to shake up Nicodemus' worldview and maybe something else besides his viewpoint. But what is it? What about Nicodemus isn't right? What's he trying to change? What's he trying to get Nicodemus to see?
Well, I was wondering if perhaps the Pharisees had come to try and make themselves safe in a world in where they have no control by putting control over those things they can control, their religion. And the Christ is mentioning here things over which one has no control, the wind, and to look back at putting faith in God instead of my table utensils I choose.
Okay. So Nicodemus is, like the Pharisees, if you'll pardon the expression, a control freak. You know, they want to have everything in order because the big picture is totally not in order. How can it be that if we're the chosen people, the Romans are in charge of everything? So let's have the little micro part of our world that we can control in as much order as we possibly can. Purity rules and tithing and all these details. But the problem is, where did all those rules come from? They come from God? Or they come from humans? You see? This is one of the core struggles of this gospel. Remember yesterday we were talking briefly at the beginning about what was the issue? Okay, so you believe in Jesus. Then what? What do you do? If you say, well, every morning, every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, we come to this place for worship. Okay, we can do that. Did God tell us to do that? No. You know, if you don't come to worship at 10 o'clock on Sunday, are you going to hell? Probably not. If you don't go to Vespers, it's... Well, no. You know, we need to remember which of these things we made up because they're convenient ways to be a community together, and which things are commandments from God. The trouble is that Nicodemus has lost track of which is which. The Pharisees have come to believe, or at least to proclaim, who knows what they really believe in their hearts. This gospel doesn't get that deep into the psychology of it. That all these rules are from God. Jesus saw when he came to the temple, you've got it backwards. You've converted what's supposed to be a place of life into an economic institution. You're just making money off this religion here. It's supposed to be, the tithing is supposed to be to redistribute wealth. So there are no poor people in Israel. Go read Leviticus sometime. Huh? You know, we're all supposed to have an equal amount. If your crop is better than mine and my crop's bad after a few years, well, after 7 years, it all comes equal again. That's the sabbatical year, huh? And every 50 years, the Sabbath of Sabbaths, it all comes equal. Boy, don't try and loan money in the 48th year. Which is precisely what happened, and precisely why the temple went bad. Well, gosh, I borrow some money, or I won't have any crop for next year. Well, if I loan you money this year, and over the next 7 years, next year the debt's no good. Imagine if every 50 years, all debts were wiped out. Wouldn't do much for capitalism, would it? No? Well, that was what the law said. Every 50 years, all debts are wiped out. We start from scratch. You know, some people are more talented, some people get better weather, better land, but it's not supposed to give you a long-term advantage. So every 50 years we start over, boards wiped clean. Not a very practical way to run a society, is it? And it was no longer really run that way. That's part of what went wrong, among other things. Yeah.
Born from water and the Spirit, I guess I always thought that meant... being baptized and taking communion?
Well, let's save the communion part till we get to John 6. Baptized. No, that's not so difficult to understand, is it? Right? Born of water and spirit is about baptized. Now, Nicodemus, to give him fairness here, in the 30s or 20s when the story world is taking place, couldn't possibly have understood that that's what was being asked of him. That's not what's relevant here. What's relevant is the telling time in the 90s or so when the gospel was written to that audience, when Christianity had already been around for a couple of generations and baptism was a well-established practice. What would be the implication for Nicodemus, someone like Nicodemus, say in the 80s and 90s, to be baptized a Christian? What would happen to his life? He loses his pension. Loses job. Loses. He'd lose everything. He'd lose everything. He'd lose his social status. He'd lose his friends. He'd lose everything. In other words, he'd have to be born again. He'd have to start life all over again. You know, like Paul says, you got to be buried with Christ at baptism and rise up a new person. Same reality, a little different metaphor. And what's Nicodemus' response in 3:9?
How can these things be?
How can this be? Literally, how is this possible? Now, we have to give Nicodemus some credit for understanding. He doesn't say to Jesus, I don't know what you're talking about. In the Last Supper discourse, later on, the disciples say precisely that to Jesus. We don't know what he's talking about. So presumably the author of the story could have said, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. But instead he says, how is this possible? Which presumes that he does, at some level, know what Jesus is talking about. But wonders, how could it be? How could it be that I, who have been devoting my whole life to God's law, have my vocation as being a teacher of these holy traditions, and being asked to give it all up in order to be a member of the reign of God, in order to enter, is the language there, the reign of God? How is that possible? That can be what God is asking you to do. And that's where Jesus responds, you're a teacher of Israel and you don't know these things? And then Nicodemus just fades away. Fades back in the darkness. He's going to come back again in a couple of minutes. More than a couple of minutes, but depends on how fast we read, I guess. This contrast between born from above, born again, and born from below, which Jesus goes on to speak about here, we won't take the time to look at it now, is one of a series of metaphors that this gospel uses to contrast what the prophet Isaiah understood hundreds of years before. My ways are not your ways, says God. My ways are so far above your ways, you know. And this gospel uses several sets of interlinked metaphors to convey that. Above and below. Earth and heaven. There's another one we just had here. Flesh and spirit. Now, what were some of you taught when Jesus says to Nicodemus, what is born of flesh is flesh, born of the will of flesh, prologue, and what is born of the spirit is spirit? What is born of flesh? What's this, you know, problem with the flesh? What's he talking about?
Sexuality.
That's what we're taught, isn't it? Sexuality. To be a Christian is to think there's something wrong with sexuality. Well, it doesn't say anything about sexuality here, does it? In fact, sexuality is hardly ever a topic in the Gospels. It's only a topic in the churches. Jesus didn't have much of anything at all to say about sexuality. If the flesh is so bad, if sexuality is bad, then how come the Word is found in it? Right? Isn't that the core of the prologue? The Word became flesh? Well, what would God be doing in flesh if it's such bad stuff? Not only that, didn't God make it? So maybe we're not supposed to take this literally. Maybe it's a metaphor, like almost everything else in John's Gospel. Like Paul uses flesh in contrast with spirit, this identical way. Somebody said,
well, are we interpreting that as a negative then? Because I don't see that as being negative.
No.
Flesh gives birth to flesh. Are we saying that's negative?
Well, what do you think? What do you think the contrast is intended to express?
The way that I see this is that he's drawing the parallel. He's saying, well, one way to interpret it is to say, you're born of parents, flesh gives birth to flesh, and you're born of God, spirit gives birth to spirit. Both are good.
Okay.
Both have their proper place.
The only problem with that, if we look at the big pictures, and later on in John 6, Jesus says, the flesh is useless.
Is it the same word in Greek?
Same word, sarx. 663, the flesh is useless. Unless you munch my flesh, he says. Boy, there's this issue about flesh, isn't there? I want to suggest for the sake of time here that what he's contrasting is the same thing Isaiah was contrasting. The human way of thinking, the human way of being, and God's way of being. Yes, it's about earthly birth and heavenly birth. But what are the implications of that? He's suggesting to Nicodemus' great shock that all of your religious traditions here is flesh. You made it up, Nicodemus. It's not from God. Humans made this stuff up here. But that doesn't mean there isn't teaching from God. You who called me a teacher sent from God, after all. And I'm here to tell you what it is. That's why you have this gospel. So Jesus can help them distinguish what is flesh from spirit, what is human-made reality, so that you would, like in the prologue, to not be born of the will of the flesh, but to be born of God. Okay. So Nicodemus is challenged here to be baptized and to lose everything. But of course, as we would say, to gain everything. To lose everything that's flesh, and gain everything in spirit. Well, Nicodemus gets two more chances in this gospel, and his appearances are really sort of the human pillars upon which the gospel is framed. He's here at the beginning in his first encounter. He's here in chapter 7, and I invite you to turn to that now, specifically to 7:45 and following, where at the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus has again done terribly disruptive things. By this time, the conspiracy to kill him is out in the open. The crowd's mumbling about, you know, are they going to kill him? Why haven't they killed him yet? The Pharisees have sent the police out to arrest him. And in another wonderfully funny political cartoon, the police come back and this happens. Verse 45. The police came back to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and the latter said to them, "Why didn't you bring him in?" And the police said, "No one has ever spoken like this before." Now, imagine, you know, the police have been dazzled here. In turn, the Pharisees said, "Don't tell us you've been misled too. None of the rulers or the Pharisees have believed him, have they?" Have they? None of them have they? Nobody they know about. "But this crowd that doesn't know the law are accursed people." Typical elite attitude toward the masses, huh? If they only had Master of Divinity degrees like we do, they'd understand how God is. Now, Nicodemus, who had come to him before and was one of them, one of whom? It is ambiguous, isn't it? One of the Pharisees and or one of those who believe in him. See, Nicodemus walks this line between light and dark, and the narrator, the writer here is just, you know, fabulous at keeping him right on the knife's edge. Now, what might we as Christian communities under persecution in the late first century hope that Nicodemus, this ruler of the Pharisees who came to Jesus and believed that he's a teacher sent from God, would say at this point in the face of the question, "None of the rulers of the Pharisees have believed in him, have they?" What would you hope for?
I do!
Yeah. Here's one! And what do we get instead? "Our law doesn't judge a person unless first it is heard from him and come to know what he's doing, does it?" The gospel's calling for a witness, and Nicodemus provides due process. And that's the way it is, huh? He doesn't put one ounce of himself on the line there. Let's appeal to what we have in common here. Who cares what I think? Maybe if they provide him a hearing, they'll all listen and they'll be mesmerized too, and I won't have to say anything. You know, I'll be off the hook. But that even that doesn't get him off the hook at this point. And they say to him, "You're not from Galilee too, are you?" Big slur, you know. Look and see that no prophet is to be raised up out of Galilee. And what's Nicodemus have to say to that? Nothing. End of scene. Curtain comes down. Okay? Wow, it's hard. One more chance Nicodemus gets. Anybody know where it is? You already have reference to it. Somebody knew. They get to deal with Jesus' dead body. Down in 1938 and following. And again, lest you hear me painting Nicodemus as the bad guy, I'm, you know, sort of just trying to emphasize the ambiguity. We've often seen Nicodemus as such a hero, but I'm just trying to point out how terribly ambiguous his character is here and how important that is for the questions of faith we're presented with today. Okay. Now, here's Jesus dead, and the narrator has shown how this is all a great fulfillment of Scripture and this has all happened according to the way it's supposed to be, and, you know, all these wonderful things have gone on. Now, after this, Joseph of Arimathea, a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Judeans, asked Pilate that he might take away Jesus' body, and Pilate gave him permission. Now that's an amazing thing in itself, but we don't have time to look at it right now. And they came and took his body away. Nicodemus too, the one who had come to him at night the first time, came bringing a roll of myrrh and aloes weighing about 100 pounds. And they took Jesus' body and bound it with bandages and spices, in accordance with the Judean burial ethos, custom. And the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. And because it was the preparation of the Judeans, they laid Jesus there because the tomb was near. Now, What do you make about Nicodemus and Joseph Arimathea's act here? What do you think?
Religious power and power of commerce. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man by tradition.
Yeah, it doesn't characterize him that way here. In another gospel, it describes him as a man of great repute, a landowner. Here, he's characterized in the way that counts, a secret disciple for fear of the Judeans.
Well, and the disciples couldn't really lay Jesus in the tomb because they were in danger, too, or they were certainly afraid.
Yeah, and some of them were even at the foot of the cross, which wouldn't have been such a safe place to be either.
You wouldn't think this was a very politically smart thing for these people to have done.
No. What would have been the consequence among the Pharisees to touch a dead body on the day before Passover? Anybody know?
Isn't it seven days?
30 days.
30 days.
Can't eat the Passover for 30 days. So Nicodemus and Joseph are taking a big risk here. Either they break their own law for the sake of appearances, you know, they eat the Passover anyway, so no one notices, or they take the risk of people saying, how come you're not eating the Passover, Nicodemus? Well, I've touched a dead body. Well, whose? That's a tough situation. So he's taking a great risk going to Pilate and anointing this body. But
I have a question.
Yeah.
And here it doesn't say that they necessarily were any longer keeping it secret, though.
True. It doesn't say that.
I mean,
although, who would know that they went to Pilate?
Well, Pilate would know.
Pilate would know. Pilate, as Pilate says to Jesus, I'm not a Judean, am I? Mm-hmm. Or is he? But that's another question. Okay. Is it secret or isn't it secret? Now, what about this grand burial? 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes, or 70, depending upon how you measure. Burial fit for a king, huh? Mm-hmm. Where did it all come from? He wasn't keeping it under his cloak. Right? That's a big amount of stuff. And the bandages to go with it. You know?
They went shopping.
They planned for this. Now, the last time Nicodemus was on the line, he could have said, I believe in him, and instead he offered due process. What could Nicodemus have done this time? Instead of preparing for Jesus' burial, what could he have done? Prevented it! He was in a perfect position to say among the Pharisees, no! This is wrong! We shouldn't be doing this. And the response could have been two things. You're out of here, Nicodemus. Which is precisely what the gospel is looking to have him do. It happens to the blind person in chapter 9, right? He testifies to what happened to him and they throw him out. Nicodemus could have spoken the truth and gotten thrown out, or he could have changed history. Instead, he buries Jesus. Royal burial. Now there's a couple more things about gender relations in here for you folks for your next session or sometime. Do we recall an earlier scene in this gospel where Jesus was anointed for his burial? Mm-hmm. Remember Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus?
Yeah.
And after Lazarus came out of the tomb, and Mary anoints Jesus, and Judas gets upset about it, and Jesus says, leave her alone, what she's done is in view of my burial. Now, there's two ways we can read what Nicodemus and Joseph do here. Either it doesn't count because she was a woman, and legally it would not have counted because she was a woman, or they weren't there and they didn't know about it. Either way, they are showing that they're living in accordance with the Judean ethos here, not the emerging Christian ethos. Okay. Either they should have been part of the community and respected Mary's anointing, or they should have understood that throughout this gospel, as we'll see, Jesus is breaking down all these barriers to say what men are supposed to do, what women are supposed to do, what roles that gender has in the community of God. Okay. Nicodemus, I'll stop in a moment here, but Nicodemus is painted absolutely on the knife's edge of wanting his cake and eating it too. And I'll tell you, if you don't feel that resonate in your heart, like I do in mine, of we want our success in the world and our adulation from all the people around us, and we want to be right with God. But according to this gospel, You can't do both at the same time. You know, we are so much people of both and the gospel is so uncomfortable to us because it makes life the either-or choice. At the end of the so-called Book of Signs, the collection of Jesus' public events that take place in this gospel before the so-called Book of Glory, the narrator sort of sums it all up in chapter 12 and tries to explain why it went down this way, you know, why it didn't happen, that the Messiah came into the world and everybody believed in him. And after quoting Isaiah, a common quote from the New Testament about he blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts so they should not see and be converted, he says this in 12:42 and 43. Just the same, many of the rulers did believe in him, but because of the Pharisees, they would not confess it, so they would not be thrown out of the synagogue, because they loved the glory of humanity more than the glory of God. And that is the key here to Nicodemus, to have to choose which is it you prefer. We don't want to make that choice. But the presence of Jesus in our midst is intended through baptism to force us to that choice. But we've tamed baptism greatly. And I've heard a number of people talk about it. Some of us were talking about it last night. You know, it becomes sort of a private family affair that takes place in the church. You know, it's a party, it's a celebration, but it's not a life commitment. We do it to babies, for God's sake. You know, what choice could they be making about their future and their commitments? What sense does it make for someone who's just been born to be born again? But for adults who would have been the subjects of baptism for the first 300 years of Christianity, it made all the difference. And we'll look at this a little more when we get to the John 6 about Eucharist. Baptism is the first moment of public commitment, and Eucharist is the repeating, ongoing moment of public commitment. And as we'll see there, the disciples say, this is a hard word. Who can accept it? I just want to leave you with a question and one final anecdote. Just to be thinking about today. What are our own loyalties or our own elements of appeal to the glory of humanity that we might be called during this time in our own life to take a close look at and see if they're interfering with our responding to our baptismal call? Is it excessive patriotism, excessive commitment to our family of origin, commitment to our particular religious tradition? Some other thing that happens in our own life, our glory we get from our job or our neighbors or our garden, our beautiful lawn or whatever it might be, our fancy car. Just reflect a little bit on how we may be trying to have our cake and eat it too, and the gospel may be calling us to let one of them go so we can have the greater glory.